The natural assumption that objects, like particles, are real things that run their course in space and time according to causal laws, regardless of whether we are around to observe them or not, is repudiated by quantum mechanics. This is especially significant because quantum mechanics is the theory of physics. It has explained successfully everything from subatomic particles to stellar phenomena. There never has been a more successful theory. It has no competition. Therefore, when we look at the tracks in a bubble chamber, we are left with the question, what made them? The best answer that physicists have so far is that particles are actually interactions between fields. A field, like a wave, is spread out over a much larger area than a particle. A particle is restricted to one point. A field, moreover, completely fills a given space, like the gravitational field of the Earth fills all of the space immediately around it. When two fields interact with each other, they interact neither gradually nor at all their areas of contact. Rather, when two fields interact, they do it instantaneously and at one single point in space, instantaneously and locally. These instantaneous and local interactions make what we call particles. In fact, according to this theory, these instantaneous and local interactions are particles. The continual creation and annihilation of particles at the subatomic level is the result of the continual interaction of different fields. This theory is called quantum field theory. Some major cornerstones of the theory were laid in 1928 by the English physicist Paul Dirac. Quantum field theory has been highly successful in predicting new types of particles and in explaining existing particles in terms of field interactions. According to this theory, a separate field is associated with each type of particle. Since only three types of particles were known in 1928, only three different fields were required to explain them. The problem today, however, is that there are over 100 known particles, which, according to quantum field theory, require over 100 different fields. This abundance of theoretical fields is somewhat awkward, not to mention embarrassing, to physicists whose goal is to simplify nature. Therefore, most physicists have given up the idea of a separate field existing for each type of particle. Nevertheless, quantum field theory is still an important theory, not only because it works, but also because it was the first theory to merge quantum mechanics and relativity, albeit in a limited way. All physical theories, including quantum theory, must satisfy the requirement of relativity theory that the laws of physics be independent of the state of motion of the observer. Attempts to integrate the theory of relativity with quantum theory, however, have been generally unsuccessful. Nevertheless, both relativity and quantum theory are required and routinely used in the understanding of particle physics. Their forced relationship is best described as strained but necessary. In this regard, one of the most successful integrations of the two is quantum field theory, although it covers only a relatively small range of phenomena. Quantum field theory is an ad hoc theory. That means that, like Bohr's famous specific orbits-only model of the atom, quantum field theory is a practical but conceptually inconsistent scheme. Some parts of it don't fit together mathematically. It is a working model designed around the available data to give physicists a place to stand in the exploration of subatomic phenomena. The reason that it has been around so long is that it works so well. Some physicists think that it may work too well. They fear that the pragmatic success of quantum field theory impedes the development of a consistent theory. Even with these well-known shortcomings, the fact is that quantum field theory is a successful physical theory, and it is premised on the assumption that physical reality is essentially non-substantial. According to quantum field theory, fields alone are real. They are the substance of the universe and not matter. Matter, particles, is simply the momentary manifestations of interacting fields, which, intangible and insubstantial as they are the only real things in the universe. Their interactions seem particle-like because fields interact very abruptly and in very minute regions of space. Quantum field theory is, of course, an outrageous contradiction in terms. A quantum is an indivisible whole. It is a small piece of something, while a field is a whole area of something. A quantum field is the juxtaposition of two irreconcilable concepts. In other words, it is a paradox. It defies our categorical imperative that something be either this or that, but not both. The major contribution of quantum mechanics to Western thought, and there are many, may be its impact on the artificial categories by which we structure our perceptions, since ossified structures of perception are the prisons in which we unknowingly become prisoners. Quantum theory boldly states that something can be this and that, a wave and a particle. It makes no sense to ask which of these is really the true description. Both of them are required for a complete understanding. In 1922, Werner Heisenberg, as a student, asked his professor and friend-to-be, Niels Bohr, "If the inner structure of the atom is as closed to descriptive accounts as you say, if we really lack a language for dealing with it, how can we ever hope to understand atoms?" Bohr hesitated for a moment and then said, "I think we may yet be able to do so, but in the process we may have to learn what the word understanding really means." In human terms, it means that the same person can be good and evil, bold and timid, a lion and a lamb. All of the above notwithstanding, particle physicists of necessity analyze subatomic particles as if they were like little baseballs that fly through space and collide with each other. When a particle physicist studies a track on a bubble chamber photograph of a particle interaction, he assumes that it was made by a little moving object, and that the other tracks on the photograph likewise were made by small moving objects. In fact, particle interactions are analyzed in much the same terms that can be applied to the collision of billiard balls. Some particles collide and are annihilated in the process, and other newly created particles come flying out of the collision area. In short, particle interactions are analyzed essentially in terms of masses, velocities, and momenta. These are the concepts of Newtonian physics, and they also apply to automobiles and streetcars. Physicists do this because they have to use these concepts if they are to communicate at all. What is available to them is usually a black photograph with white lines on it. They know that, one, according to quantum theory, subatomic particles have no independent existence of their own. Two, subatomic particles have wave-like characteristics as well as particle-like characteristics. And three, subatomic particles actually may be manifestations of interacting fields. Nonetheless, these white lines, more patterns, lend themselves to analysis in classical terms, and so that is how particle physicists analyze them. This dilemma, the dilemma of having to talk in classical terms about phenomena which cannot be described in classical concepts, is the basic paradox of quantum mechanics. It pervades every part of it. It is like trying to explain an LSD experience. We try to use familiar concepts as points of departure, but beyond that, the familiar concepts do not fit the phenomena. The alternative is to say nothing at all. Physicists who deal with the quantum theory, wrote Heisenberg, are also compelled to use a language taken from ordinary life. We act as if there really were such a thing as an electric current or a particle, because if we forbade all physicists to speak of electric current or particles, they could no longer express their thoughts. Therefore, physicists talk about subatomic particles as if they were real little objects that leave tracks in bubble chambers and have an independent, objective existence. This convention has been extremely productive. Over the last 40 years, almost 100 particles have been discovered. They constitute what Kenneth Ford calls the particle zoo. Footnote: one of the finest popular books on particle physics is The World of Elementary Particles by Kenneth Ford, New York, Blaisdell, 1965. End of footnote. The first thing to know about the particle zoo is that every particle of the same species looks exactly alike. Every electron looks exactly like every other electron. If you've seen one, you've seen them all. Likewise, every proton looks exactly like every other proton. Every neutron looks exactly like every other neutron, and so on. Subatomic particles of the same type are absolutely indistinguishable. Subatomic particles of different types, however, can be recognized by their distinguishing characteristics, properties. The first distinguishing characteristic of a subatomic particle is its mass. A proton, for example, has about 1,800 times more mass than an electron. This does not necessarily mean that a proton is 1,800 times larger than an electron, since mass and size are not the same thing. A pound of lead and a pound of feathers have the same mass. When physicists refer to the mass of a particle, unless they indicate otherwise, they are referring to the mass of the particle when it is at rest. The mass of a particle at rest is called its rest mass. Any mass other than a rest mass is called a relativistic mass. Since the mass of a particle increases with velocity, a particle can have any number of relativistic masses. The size of a particle's relativistic mass depends upon its velocity. For example, at 99% of the speed of light, a particle's mass is 7 times larger than it is when the particle is at rest. At velocities above 99% of the speed of light, particle masses increase dramatically. When the former electron accelerator at Cambridge, Massachusetts, was in operation, it received electrons from a small feeder accelerator. The electrons from the feeder accelerator were fed into the main accelerator at 0.99986 times the velocity of light. The main accelerator then increased the velocity of these electrons to 0.99999996 times the speed of light. This increase in velocity may look significant, but actually it is negligible. The difference between the initial velocity of the accelerated electrons and the final velocity of the accelerated electrons is the same as the difference in velocity between one automobile that can make a given trip in 2 hours and a faster automobile that can make the same trip in 1 hour, 59 minutes, and 59 seconds. The mass of each electron, however, increased from 60 times to as much as 11,800 times the electron rest mass. In other words, particle accelerators are misnamed. They do not increase the velocities of subatomic particles, the definition of acceleration, as much as they increase their mass. Particle accelerators are actually particle enlargers, massifiers. The masses of particles, whether at rest or in motion, are measured in electron volts. An electron volt has nothing to do with electrons. An electron volt is a unit of energy. It is the energy required by any particle with 1 unit of charge falling through a potential difference of 1 volt. The point is that to measure something in terms of electron volts is to measure its energy. Yet this is precisely the unit of measurement that particle physicists use to measure a particle's mass. For example, the rest mass of an electron is 0.51 million electron volts, and the rest mass of a proton is 938.2 million electron volts. The transformation of mass into energy and energy into mass is such a routine phenomenon in particle physics that particle physicists employ units of energy to designate a particle's mass. Mass is only one particular form of energy, the energy of being. If a particle is moving, it not only has energy of being, its mass, but it also has energy of motion, kinetic energy. Both types of energy can be used to create new particles in a particle collision. Often it is easier to compare a particle's mass with the lightest massive particle, the electron, instead of referring to the number of electron volts it contains. This arrangement makes the mass of an electron 1 and the mass of a proton, for example, 1,836.12. Using this system, the mass of any particle tells immediately how much heavier it is than an electron. When physicists listed all the known particles by the order of their masses, from the lightest to the heaviest, they discovered that subatomic particles fall into roughly 3 categories: the lightweight particles, the mediumweight particles, and the heavyweight particles. When it came to naming these categories, however, they unaccountably lapsed into Greek again. The group of lightweight particles they called leptons, which is Greek for the light ones. The group of medium-weight particles they called mesons, which is Greek for the medium-sized ones. The group of heavyweight particles they called baryons, which is Greek for the heavy ones. Why physicists did not call these new groups light, medium, and heavy is one of the unanswerable questions of physics. Footnote. Physicists no longer use the terms leptons, mesons, and baryons to refer to particle mass alone. These terms now refer to classes of particles which are defined by several properties in addition to mass. For example, the tau particle, which was discovered by a joint team from the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center and the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory in 1975, seems to be a lepton even though it has more mass than the heaviest baryon. Similarly, the D particles, also discovered by a joint SLAC-LBL team in 1976, are mesons, even though they have more mass than the tau particle. End of footnote. Since the electron is the lightest material particle, it is, of course, a lepton. The proton is a heavyweight particle, a baryon, although it is the lightest of the heavyweight particles. Most subatomic particles are classified in this way, but not all of them, which brings us to a phenomenon of particle physics which, like much of quantum mechanics, escapes the bounds of concept. A few particles do not fit into the lepton, meson, baryon framework. Some of them are well known, like the photon, and others have been theorized but not discovered yet, like the graviton. All of them have in common the fact that they are massless particles. "Wait a minute," we exclaim. "What is a massless particle?" "A massless particle," says Jim DeWitt, who has studied this phenomenon, "is a particle that has zero rest mass. All of its energy is energy of motion. When a photon is created, it instantly is traveling at the speed of light. It cannot be slowed down, it has no mass to slow, and it cannot be speeded up. Nothing can travel faster than the speed of light." Massless particle is an awkward translation from mathematics to English. Physicists know exactly what they mean by a massless particle. A massless particle is the name they give to an element in a mathematical structure. What that element represents in the real world, however, is not so easy to describe. In fact, it is impossible because the definition of an object, like a particle, is something that has mass. Zen Buddhists have developed a technique called the koan, which, along with meditation, produces changes in our perceptions and understanding. A koan is a puzzle which cannot be answered in ordinary ways because it is paradoxical. What is the sound of one hand clapping is a Zen koan. Zen students are told to think unceasingly about a particular koan until they know the answer. There is no single correct answer to a koan. It depends upon the psychological state of the student. Paradoxes are common in Buddhist literature. Paradoxes are the places where our rational mind bumps into its own limitations. According to Eastern philosophy in general, opposites, such as good-bad, beautiful-ugly, birth-death, and so on, are false distinctions. One cannot exist without the other. They are mental structures which we have created. These self-made and self-maintained illusions are the sole cause of paradoxes. To escape the bonds of conceptual limitation is to hear the sound of one hand clapping. Physics is replete with koans, i.e., picture a massless particle. Is it a coincidence that Buddhists exploring internal reality a millennium ago and physicists exploring external reality a millennium later both discovered that understanding involves passing the barrier of paradox? The second characteristic of a subatomic particle is its charge. Every subatomic particle has a positive, a negative, or a neutral charge. Its charge determines how the particle will behave in the presence of other particles. If a particle has a neutral charge, it is utterly indifferent to other particles, regardless of what charge they may have. Particles with positive and negative charges, however, behave quite differently toward each other. Positively and negatively charged particles are attracted to particles with the opposite sign and repelled by particles with the same sign. Two positively charged particles, for example, find each other's company quite repulsive and immediately put as much distance between themselves as possible. The same is true of two negatively charged particles. A negatively charged particle and a positively charged particle, on the other hand, are irresistibly attracted to each other, and they immediately move toward one another if they are able to do so. This dance of attraction and repulsion between charged particles is called the electromagnetic force. It enables atoms to join together to form molecules, and it keeps negatively charged electrons in orbit around positively charged nuclei. At the atomic and molecular level, it is the fundamental glue of the universe. Electric charge comes only in one fixed amount. A subatomic particle can have no electrical charge, neutral, or one unit of electrical charge, either positive or negative, or in certain instances two units of electrical charge, but nothing in between. There is no such thing as a particle with 1 1/4 units of electrical charge or a particle with 1.7 units of electrical charge. Every subatomic particle has either one whole unit of electrical charge, two whole units of electrical charge, or no electrical charge at all. In other words, like energy, Planck's discovery, electrical charge is quantized. It comes in chunks. In the case of electrical charge, all of the chunks are the same size. Why this is so is one of the unanswered questions in physics. When the characteristic of charge is added to the characteristic of mass, a particle personality, so to speak, begins to emerge. An electron, for example, is the only subatomic particle with a rest mass of 0.51 million electron volts and a negative charge. With this information, a particle physicist knows not only how massive an electron is, he also knows how it will interact with other particles. The third characteristic of a subatomic particle is its spin. Subatomic particles spin about a theoretical kind of axis, like a spinning top. One big difference between a spinning top and a spinning particle, however, is that a top can spin either faster or slower. But a subatomic particle always spins at exactly the same rate. Every electron, for example, always spins at exactly the same rate as every other electron. The rate of spin is such a fundamental characteristic of a subatomic particle that if it is altered, the particle itself is destroyed. That is, if the spin of a particle is altered, the particle in question is changed so fundamentally that it no longer can be considered an electron or a proton or whatever it was before we altered its spin. This makes us wonder whether all of the different particles might be just different states of motion of some underlying structure or substance. This is the basic question of particle physics. Every phenomenon in quantum mechanics has a quantum aspect which makes it discontinuous. This is also true of spin. Spin is quantized, just like energy and charge. It comes in chunks. Like charge, all of the chunks are the same size. In other words, when a spinning top slows down, its rotation does not diminish smoothly and continuously, but in a series of tiny steps. These steps are so small and close together that it is impossible to observe them. The top appears to spin more and more slowly until it stops spinning altogether, but actually the process is very jerky. It is as if the top could spin by some strange law that nobody understands, only at 100 revolutions per minute, 90 revolutions per minute, 80 revolutions per minute, and so on, with absolutely no exceptions in between. If our hypothetical top wants to spin slower than 100 revolutions per minute, it must jump all the way down to the next slower speed of 90 revolutions per minute. This is analogous to the situation with subatomic particles, except that, one, particular types of particles forever spin at the same speed, and two, the spin of subatomic particles is calculated in terms of angular momentum. Angular momentum depends upon the size, mass, and rate of rotation of a spinning object. More of any one of these properties increases the angular momentum of the object. In general, angular momentum is the strength of the rotation. Or, put another way, the effort required to stop the rotation. The more angular momentum an object has, the more effort is required to stop it from spinning. A spinning top does not have much angular momentum because it is small and it has little mass. A merry-go-round, in comparison, has an enormous angular momentum, not because it rotates very fast, but because it is large and it has so much mass. Now that you understand spin, forget everything that you've just learned except the bottom line, angular momentum. Every subatomic particle has a fixed, definite, and known angular momentum, but nothing is spinning. If you don't understand, don't worry. Physicists don't understand these words either. They just use them. If you try to understand them, they become a koan. The angular momentum of a subatomic particle is fixed, definite, and known. But, wrote Max Born, one should not imagine that there is anything in the nature of matter actually rotating. Said another way, the spin of a subatomic particle involves the idea of a spin without the existence of something spinning. Even Born had to admit that this concept is rather abstruse. Rather. Nonetheless, physicists use this concept because subatomic particles do behave as if they have angular momentum, and that angular momentum has been determined to be fixed and definite in each case. Because of this, in fact, spin is one of the major characteristics of subatomic particles. The angular momentum of a subatomic particle is based upon our old friend Planck's constant. Remember that Planck's constant, which physicists call the quantum of action, was the discovery that set into motion the revolution of quantum mechanics. Planck discovered that energy is emitted and absorbed not continuously, but in small packages, which he called quanta. Since that initial discovery, Planck's constant, which represents the quantized nature of energy emission and absorption, has appeared again and again as an essential element in the understanding of subatomic phenomena. 5 years after Planck's discovery, Einstein used Planck's constant to explain the photoelectric effect, and later still he used it to determine the specific heat of solids, an area far removed from Planck's original study of blackbody radiation. Bohr discovered that the angular momentum of electrons as they orbit atomic nuclei is a function of Planck's constant. De Broglie used Planck's constant to calculate the wavelength of matter waves, and it is a central element in Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. As important as Planck's constant is in the realm of subatomic particles, however, it is entirely unobservable in the world at large. This is because the size of the packages by which energy is emitted and absorbed is so small that energy at our gross level appears to be one continuous flow. Similarly, because the indivisible unit of angular momentum is so small, it too cannot be observed in the macroscopic world. A spectator swiveling in his chair at a tennis match has 10 to the 33rd power times more angular momentum than an electron. Put another way, a change of one penny in the gross national product of the United States is a disturbance more than a billion billion times greater than a change by one unit of the spectator's angular momentum. Instead of writing out the actual angular momentum of a subatomic particle, physicists usually indicate the spin of a subatomic particle by comparing it to the spin of a photon, whose spin they call 1. This system has revealed yet another unexplainable pattern of subatomic phenomena. Entire families of particles have similar spin characteristics. The entire family of leptons, the lightweight particles, for example, has a spin of 1/2, which means that they all have an angular momentum which is 1/2 of a photon's angular momentum. The same is true for the entire family of baryons, the heavyweight particles. The mesons also have peculiar spin characteristics. They spin in such a way that their angular momenta is always either 0, 1, 2, 3, etc., in relation to the angular momentum of a photon, but nothing in between. 0 equals no spin, 1 equals the same angular momentum as a photon, 2 equals twice the angular momentum of a photon, etc. The values of a particle's charge, spin, and other major characteristics are represented by specific numbers. These numbers are called quantum numbers. Every particle has a set of quantum numbers which identify it as a particular type of particle. Footnote. The basic quantum numbers are spin, isotopic spin, charge, strangeness, charm, baryon number, and lepton number. End of footnote. Every particle of a particular type has the same set of quantum numbers as every other particle of the same type. Every electron, for example, has the same quantum numbers as every other electron. An electron's quantum numbers, however, distinguish it from protons, all of which also have the same quantum numbers. Individual particles don't have much personality. In fact, they don't have any personality at all. When Dirac imposed the requirements of relativity on quantum theory, his formalism indicated the existence of a particular positively charged particle. Since the only positively charged particle known in those days, 1928, was the proton, Dirac and most other physicists assumed that his theory had accounted, mathematically, for the proton. His theory even was criticized for yielding the wrong proton mass. Upon closer examination, however, it became evident that Dirac's theory described not the proton, but an entirely different particle. Dirac's new particle was like an electron, except that its charge and some of its other major properties were exactly the opposite to those of an electron. In 1932, Carl Anderson at Caltech, who hadn't heard of Dirac's theory, actually discovered this new particle and called it a positron. Physicists later discovered that every particle has a counterpart, which is exactly like it but opposite in several major respects. This new class of particles was called antiparticles. An antiparticle, despite its name, is a particle. The antiparticle of an antiparticle is another particle. Some particles have other particles as antiparticles. For example, a positive pi meson is the antiparticle of a negative pi meson and the other way around. A few particles are their own antiparticles, like the photon. The meeting of a particle and its antiparticle is always spectacular. Whenever a particle and its antiparticle meet, they annihilate each other. When an electron meets a positron, for example, both of them disappear, and in their place are two photons which instantly depart the scene at the speed of light. The particle and the antiparticle literally disappear in a puff of light. Conversely, particles and antiparticles can be created out of energy, and always in pairs. The universe is made of both particles and antiparticles. Our part of it, however, is made almost entirely of regular particles, which combine into regular atoms to make regular molecules, which make regular matter, which is what we are made of. Physicists speculate that in other parts of the universe, antiparticles combine into anti-atoms to make anti-molecules, which make anti-matter, which is what anti-people would be made of. There are no anti-people in our part of the universe because, if there were, they all long since have disappeared in a flash of light. Leptons, mesons, baryons, mass, charge, spin, and antiparticles are some of the concepts that physicists use to categorize subatomic phenomena when they momentarily assume that subatomic particles are real objects that move through space and time. These concepts are useful, but only in a limited context. That context is when physicists, for convenience, pretend, as we all do, that dancers can exist apart from a dance. Chapter 1. The Dance. The dance of subatomic particles never ends, and it is never the same. However, physicists have found a way to diagram the parts of it that interest them. The simplest drawing of any type of movement is a space map. A space map shows the location of things in space. A map, for example, might show the positions of San Francisco, California, and Berkeley, California. The vertical axis is the north-south axis, as on any map, and the horizontal axis is the east-west line. The map might also show the path of a helicopter flying between San Francisco and Berkeley, and on a greatly enlarged basis, it might show the path of a proton traveling around the cyclotron at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory. Like all road maps, this space map is two-dimensional. It shows how far north, the first dimension, and how far east, the second dimension, Berkeley is of San Francisco. It does not show the altitude of the helicopter, the third dimension, and it does not indicate how much time, the fourth dimension, the flight from San Francisco to Berkeley required. If we want to show the time involved in the San Francisco-Berkeley flight, we must draw a space-time map. A space-time map shows the positions of things in space, and it also shows their positions in time. The vertical axis on a space-time map is the time axis. Space-time maps are read from the bottom up because the passage of time is represented by movement up the time axis. The horizontal axis of a space-time map is the space axis, which shows the movement of objects in space. The path traced by an object on a space-time map is called its world line. For example, a space-time map might show the same flight from San Francisco to Berkeley. Initially, the helicopter is sitting on the ground in San Francisco. When the helicopter takes off for Berkeley, it moves forward both in time and space, and its world line traces the diagonal path on the space-time map between B and C. When it lands in Berkeley, its world line is vertical once again because it no longer moves in space, but like all things, it continues to move in time, point C to point D. It can move backward and forward in space, but of course it can only move forward in time. The world lines of San Francisco and Berkeley are vertical lines, which do not move in space at all, except during California earthquakes. Physicists use similar space-time maps to diagram particle interactions. Imagine a space-time diagram of an electron emitting a photon. Starting at the lower left-hand corner of our space-time map, an electron moves through space with a certain velocity, indicated by a diagonal line moving from lower left to upper right. At a point in space and time indicated, say, by a dot, it emits a photon. The photon flies off at the speed of light, upwards and to the right, and the electron, its momentum affected by the emission of the photon, alters course and moves off more slowly at a less extreme angle, upwards and to the left. In 1949, Richard Feynman discovered that space-time maps like these have an exact correspondence with mathematical expressions, which give the probabilities of the interactions that they depict. Feynman's discovery was an extension of Dirac's 1928 theory, and it helped to evolve that theory into the quantum field theory that we know today. Therefore, this type of diagram is sometimes called a Feynman diagram. Here is a Feynman diagram of a particle-antiparticle annihilation. An electron on the left approaches an anti-electron, a positron, which is coming from the right. Their movements indicated by two diagonal lines, one starting from the lower left and one starting from the lower right. The two lines meet at the center of the space-time diagram. At their point of contact, indicated by the dot, they mutually annihilate each other, and two photons are created which depart in opposite directions at the speed of light. Their movement, in space and time, indicated by two dotted lines, moving out at flattened angles in opposite directions. A happening in the subatomic world is called an event. Events are indicated in Feynman diagrams by dots. Every subatomic event is marked by the annihilation of the initial particles and the creation of new ones. This is true for every event, and not only those involving particles and antiparticles. With this in mind, let's go back to our previous example of an electron emitting a photon. Instead of saying that an electron moving through space emitted a photon which changed its, the electron's, momentum, we can say as well that an electron moving through space emitted a photon and went out of existence at that point. A new electron was created in this process, and it departed the scene with a new momentum. There is no way of knowing if this interpretation is correct or not, because all electrons are identical. However, it is simpler and more consistent to assume that the original particle was annihilated and a new particle was created. The indistinguishability of subatomic particles makes this possible. Now we have a Feynman diagram of a process we discussed in the previous chapter. A negative pi meson collides with a proton and the two particles are annihilated. Their energy of being, mass, and energy of motion create two new particles, a lambda particle and a neutral K meson. These two new particles are unstable and live less than a billionth of a second before they decay into other particles. The neutral K meson decays into a positive pi meson and a negative pi meson. The lambda particle, and this is the interesting part, decays into the original two particles, a negative pi meson and a proton. It is as if we smash two toy automobiles together, and instead of shattering into bits and pieces, they come apart into more toy automobiles, some of which are as large as the originals. Of course, on our space-time map, all of this is indicated by a series of diagonal intersecting lines, each intersection indicated by a dot or event. Subatomic particles forever partake of this unceasing dance of annihilation and creation. In fact, subatomic particles are this unceasing dance of annihilation and creation. This 20th century discovery, with all its psychedelic implications, is not a new concept. In fact, it is very similar to the way that much of the Earth's population, including the Hindus and the Buddhists, view their reality. Hindu mythology is virtually a large-scale projection into the psychological realm of microscopic scientific discoveries. Hindu deities such as Shiva and Vishnu continually dance the creation and destruction of universes, while the Buddhist image of the wheel of life symbolizes the unending process of birth, death, and rebirth, which is a part of the world of form, which is emptiness, which is form. Imagine that a group of young artists have found a new and revolutionary school of art. Their paintings are so unique that they have come to share them with the curator of an old museum. The curator regards the new paintings, nods his head, and disappears into the vaults of the museum. He returns carrying some very old paintings, which he places beside the new ones. The new art is so similar to the old art that even the young artists are taken aback. The new revolutionaries, in their own time and in their own way, have rediscovered a very old school of painting. Let us look again at the Feynman diagram of an electron-positron annihilation. Each line indicating the motion through space and time of a particle has an arrowhead on it, indicating the direction of motion. Suppose that we use the arrowhead to indicate which is the particle, the electron, and which is the antiparticle, the positron, by making the arrowheads that point up indicate the particles, and arrowheads that point down indicate the antiparticles. That would make a new kind of diagram. Naturally, time as we experience it only travels in one direction, forward, and that is up on a space-time diagram. Nonetheless, this simple convention would give us an easy way of telling particles from antiparticles. World lines that appear to move forward in time would belong to particles, and world lines that appear to move backward in time would belong to antiparticles. Photons would not have arrowheads because they are their own antiparticles. Feynman demonstrated in 1949 that this convention is more than an artistic device. He discovered that a positron field propagating forward in time is mathematically the same as an electron field propagating backward in time. In other words, according to quantum field theory, an antiparticle is a particle moving backward in time. An antiparticle does not have to be considered as a particle moving backward in time, but that is the simplest and most symmetric way of viewing antiparticles. For example, because the arrowheads distinguish the particles from the antiparticles, we can twist the original Feynman diagram around into any position that we choose and still be able to distinguish the one from the other. Each of these variations is a separate diagram and represents a particle-antiparticle interaction. By twisting the original diagram completely around, we can represent every possible interaction between an electron, a positron, and two photons. The precision, simplicity, and symmetry of Feynman diagrams makes them a special type of poetry. Now we come to a space-time diagram of two events. A collision between two photons at point B creates an electron-positron pair, and subsequently an electron and a positron annihilate each other and create two photons at point A. Ordinarily, we would interpret these events as follows. Two photons collide in the lower right of the diagram, producing an electron-positron pair. The electron flies off to the right, while the positron flies off to the left, where it meets another electron which has entered the diagram from the lower left. There they mutually annihilate and create two photons, which depart in opposite directions. The preferred interpretation of quantum field theory, however, is much simpler. In it, there is only one particle. That particle, an electron, enters the diagram from the lower left and travels forward in time and space until it emits two photons at point A. This causes it to reverse its direction in time. Traveling backward in time as a positron, it absorbs two photons at point B, reverses its direction in time again, and again becomes an electron. Instead of three particles, there's only one particle, which, moving from left to right, travels first forward in time, then backward in time, and then forward in time again. This is the static type of space-time picture described in Einstein's theory of relativity. If we could survey an entire span of time as we can survey an entire region of space, we would see that events do not unfold with the flow of time, but present themselves complete, like a finished painting on the fabric of space-time. In such a picture, movements backward and forward in time are no more significant than movements backward and forward in space.